Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, world. It's me, Dennis, and today I'm going to have a wonderful conversation with Sarah McSorley. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Dennis. How are you?
Well, I'm doing well. We are safe and sound here in Austin, Texas. And please, let's begin the show by giving just some perspective of you as a science writer and as a scientist and as a human being. What is your situation? Where are you? And how are you adapting with this new change and with the COVID-19 and the pandemic that's going around? So that we'll acknowledge that first before we segue into your work.
Gotcha. So I definitely at one time considered myself a scientist. That's what my first degree was in, but it's been a long time since I've practiced any of that. So, you know, science writer, inclusion in science, supporter, all those things are definitely still true. Right now I'm way just more of a writer, so I don't want to speak as a scientist on the issue.
I understand that. So you're a recovering scientist, but
something like that, right?
Yeah, but once a scientist, always a scientist. Isn't a scientist a mindset?
I think that that's true, and it's studying science, it gives you a different way to approach anything. You know, to ask questions and how to find answers and approach different solutions. So it's really, I mean, even if you're not going to stay a scientist, I think studying science is still a great thing to kind of give you a different outlook on the world and how things work. But for me right now, with everything going on, I'm actually in Central Tennessee and just moved here maybe 3 weeks ago. So wasn't planning on making a move in the middle of a pandemic, but that's how it worked out. And I was moving from Northern Virginia, and the plan with my move and my job was to be fully remote anyway, because I was moving away from headquarters, but the company I work for has a lot of other remote employees. So they were, you know, supportive of keeping me on just being a full remote. But now the difference is the whole team that I work with is also remote with me. So I knew it was going to be an adjustment for me with the move before all of this, but now it's an adjustment for the whole office, trying to figure out how to make all those things work for everybody. But it's going okay so far. Just different, getting used to it, and definitely odd sort of moving somewhere new and not being able to experience the place that you moved to. I really like the place that I'm living, so that's good considering I'm not getting to see a whole lot else, but it's nice. I know I'm, you know, grateful that I have the option to keep working. I know that's not true for a lot of people.
It is. And also to be able, what a time to be in science. All right. Thank you for that perspective on where we're going. But I want to segue back to, I'm 72 this month. So I got a chance to grow up during a time when there were very, very few women in science. When and where were you 18 years old?
Oh, wow. So I'm 32 this year, so not quite as far back as you, but in a lot of ways it kind of feels like a different world.
I know.
You know, and when I was going through my training, I was in marine biology, which at least at the time I was going through it in university, I think we actually were majority female as a major. So, but sort of going through that, you know, meeting a lot of other women in different fields, and then through my job after graduation and stuff.
Let me interrupt you for a second, please. I want to go back farther. I want to go back to Sarah at coloring book years old, 7 years old, early influences, the sense of where that curiosity, that resilience that you have demonstrated at time after time in your career, as I encourage anyone to either listen or to read the podcast or read about you, is that there constantly is something that is coming up to you that is plot twist. Here we go to another direction. So
think
give
that's just
kind of,
I'm learning that as I get older, that's kind of just how life works. It's those things that you're handed. But I think as a kid, you know, I was lucky to have a really fantastic mom that sort of encouraged all my curiosities. And, you know, it was during a time where we spent a lot of time outside. That was where we played. That was where we hung out with our friends. I grew up on the Eastern Shore of Maryland. So there was a lot of time spent, you know, walking around nature preserves and by the water and, you know, trying to figure out what is this thing and why does this thing live here? Or is this supposed to be here? And, you know, just asking all those questions and, you know, being around people who encouraged me to, you know, figure it out and helped get me into, you know, activities and find books and, and things to watch to really kind of keep that curiosity going. So that was a big part of it, I think, as a kid. And plus growing up with, you know, watching a mom who dealt with the only things that, like, you know, life hands everybody stuff, like I said, you know, and I think watching my mom be resilient and, you know, taking care of me and my brother and, like, finding all these great things for us to do while she was dealing with all of her other stuff too. Like, I think, you know, having a parent that you watch do that, it helps you figure out, you know, okay, like, you know, this is what I want to do too. And this is what I can do.
When one of my heroes is Richard Feynman, and I love his stories because his stories is much like yours in that his father was a salesman, not a scientist, but his father nurtured his curiosity because whenever Richard would say something, ask about something, he would go, well, let's wonder why that is.
Yeah.
Where
let's
that comes
find
from
out,
and
right?
Nurture curiosity. Let's go find out. Let's dig deeper into that and get your curiosity fired.
Right. Right. And she was also, my mom was a big reader, still is. So I think a lot of, you know, just being encouraged to read different things, because even if it was something where, you know, I had questions about, you know, the different types of water environments, like we grew up near the Choptank River, but then you'd watch documentaries on TV about coral reefs and all this other stuff. And I'm like, yeah, I want to know more about those things too, but I was certainly nowhere near that kind of environment. But, you know, so we'd go to the library and we'd find books on it, or, you know, so there were other ways to kind of encourage how you not just encourage the curiosity, but then, like you said, you know, okay, well, let's figure it out. Let's go learn something new about it.
Well, you pursue one of the things I'm going to segue forward and then come back. You pursue and are encouraging STEM, which is science, technology, electronics, and math.
Engineering and mathematics.
Engineering, electronics.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Always push back. Always help me when I say something that is either out or I haven't clicked. Always do that, please, please, Sarah.
You got it.
Next thing I want is what I've been talking with educators about is that they wanted to make it STEAM rather than STEM to make sure the art is in there. How were you encouraged to have the art as part of your work? Did you color? Did you draw? Did you what was that part of it?
So it's funny because once the books came out, I, you know, would kind of reconnected with some folks who were part of my community, my village, so to speak, when I was younger. And, you know, they would say things like, well, you always did the art and science stuff, you know, and I necessarily didn't remember, not like I didn't remember, but I hadn't thought about it. It's kind of, I did do a lot of arts as well as science. Like, I was always in the art club and I did a lot of creative writing and some of these other things. I've always been like a crafter, make jewelry, candles, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, it was one of those things where I just sort of felt like I picked science and just kind of ran with that. But then even with that choice, you know, thinking I was going to get into research, then I realized research wasn't really for me. So I kind of pivoted to still be in the science arena, but I was doing more outreach and communication and education work in the sciences, specifically marine science, to get started. And so it was kind of nice to sort of have that come full circle. And I think, you know, I try to watch like STEAM just, or like any buzzword because I feel like the more you try to keep adding to an acronym, it could just get larger because there's benefits of a lot of different things. So
you'll be in Steamboat and Steampunk Village Time.
But I think, and I tried to address this, especially in the second volume of the Super Cool Scientist books, you know, a lot of the folks who are included in the books as scientists or engineers also have, you know, artistic sides. And I think the bottom line is whether you're in the arts or whether you're in STEM, there's sort of this like foundation level of creativity that you have as a person, right? So I think, and sometimes you do need, especially sort of in this ever-evolving world that we're in, not just one field or one type of thinker, right? Like the work that happens in science, and when I say science, it usually is broader, like could include all of STEM. It really does take, you know, people from different fields to solve a problem because problems are so interwoven. You know, you need folks who can speak to different parts of the problem, but then also folks who, you know, can have a real conversation and know how to communicate with each other. And then sometimes that includes appealing to different emotions. And sometimes that's something that an artist can bring to the table in a different way. So I don't think it's necessarily something where I think sometimes people think, oh, arts and science are so different, right brain, left brain. But when you talk about the core of what it is, it's about creativity and how do we approach these problems, right? So I don't think they're that different at the core. They're just different in their approach.
Oh, Sarah, what a beautifully articulated. That's exactly what I believe. Well said. Absolutely. Because when I study the scientists, you see that there very seldom is a scientist only in one discipline. They usually will have something in their art that they are as deeply interested in and drive as deeply as they are in their science. Maybe not as deeply, but certainly that it affects and impacts how their creative process moves forward. And you highlight this in the coloring books, which I have not had in my hand yet.
I do. And I think part of wanting to do that was sort of the whole idea behind this was, you know, sometimes when people think of scientists or engineers, like, you know, as a group, we tend to speak in a lot of jargon sometimes, like we're not always used to communicating to non-scientists, right? So I think sometimes that can be a little bit intimidating for folks who aren't familiar with those fields. So I think part of what I was really trying to do was, you know, yes, here is a group of scientists and engineers, and this is the really cool STEM-related work that we're doing, but I also just wanted to present them as people, right? Like, so these women are you know, they're sculptors, or they're painters, or they're authors, or they run their own businesses in addition to whatever their work is. They're, you know, they're parents. They have all these fun hobbies, like they're runners, or, you know, they talk about their pets. So it's just sort of the humanizing factor of these are all people, just you and me. And this is the, you know, the career path that they've chosen. And part of that is just to kind of show young people too, or, you know, older folks who want to pivot in their careers, because we know that that happens.
Absolutely.
Find some point of connection to the stories, right? So my goal with the first book that continued on to the second one was to have anybody who picked it up find at least one point that they could connect with in one of the stories, whether that was through the illustration itself, which I worked with an amazing illustrator, Yvonne Page, on this. I can't claim those as my own.
Hi, Yvonne.
She was fantastic to work with. And then, but also like through the biographies themselves, which were all based on one-on-one interviews, either on the phone or via email with the scientists and myself. So like, you know, even if somebody can't relate to, you know, wanting to be an industrial engineer, someone could maybe relate to, okay, like this is kind of how I grew up, or like, I like to go and play soccer, or, you know, I was interested in helicopters as a kid. You know, maybe they can find some other point of connection, which then makes the story feel more, you know, real. And I think in a lot of cases can sort of help someone be like, okay, like maybe I could do this too, if that's not a thought that they've had before, if they haven't seen, you know, someone who maybe looks like them reflected in these types of careers.
When did you decide, when did your early writing adventures in elementary school, junior high, what was the, what's the history of Sarah McSorley in her?
The writer.
In your writer. The writer.
It's funny because sometimes I still feel weird calling myself a writer, even though like it's even my official job title at this point. But I definitely took, I feel like I realized a lot of my writing in school, besides, you know, reports and that type of stuff. Like in high school, I did a lot of creative writing, and we had a student newspaper, and I was involved in that. So I think that's kind of when I really realized it. But a few years back, I've been helping my mom try to clear out some of my stuff, you know, now that I'm grown out of her house. And I would find, you know, old reports and, you know, things that I, even early, as early as like second or third grade, like little books that I would make for class or even just on my own. So I think I've kind of always been interested in writing. But again, it was one of those things that didn't really necessarily come into focus for me until, you know, I noticed it more in high school. And then I think through college, a lot of it was, you know, I did a lot of it for my assignments, but it wasn't necessarily my focus area. Like, I think I wrote a lot, journal just kind of for myself. Like, that's just kind of a way that I kind of process things sometimes is to write them out. But as far as doing anything so publicly, you know, and then I did a lot of grant writing as part of my professional job too. So like I wrote all the time, just a different audience in a different format. I think the first time I really ever wanted to put anything out so publicly was with the first Super Cool Scientist book. And even though I had written so much professionally and personally over the years, it still felt pretty vulnerable and raw to like want to put this out to the world, especially like I've never written a book before.
Yeah.
Like, you know, so there was some of that, what's it called? Imposter syndrome, right? So where it's like,
oh,
you know,
of course,
am I sure that this, I'm the right person to do this? But at the time, I remember I'd been trying to come up with an idea for a side project for a while and hadn't figured out exactly what that was. And at the time I was dealing with some of my own anxiety stuff, and mom was a psychology major back when, and was like, you know, back then, like we used to tell people to color to like work on their stress and stuff. And that was before coloring was such like a huge, or adult coloring books were such a
huge. I know.
So I was like, okay, well, let me try that. So I had been doing a lot of that. And then I was like, well, let me see if there's any, like, you know, women in science coloring books, because I would like one of those. And I Googled it and nothing came up at the time. And I was like, well, shoot, that never happens. So I was like, maybe this is my idea. And then I had to kind of, you know, flesh that out a little bit more and think it through and be like, you know, I can't draw it if I'm going to do, like, a coloring book full of stick figures wasn't going to work. So I had to think about who I would work with as an illustrator and how I would approach it and how I would pay for it. But then it just sort of, I realized that this was something that I felt like people really wanted and needed, like, and it would fill a niche for some people. And it's been, you know, I haven't really been able to focus on it recently, but the whole experience has been pretty incredible.
Wow. So how did you, let's go back to the idea. All right, now, you've got this idea. What happens next? Was Yvonne in your life?
I did know Yvonne. I hadn't necessarily initially thought, oh, she should be my illustrator, but we both were working in higher education at the time. I was working at a university. She was working at a different university down the road with our, you know, 9-to-5 day jobs. And and I knew I wanted someone who... Like, I wanted the illustrations to be pretty realistic. Like, I didn't want it to be like a caricature of the people, you know, so I wanted someone who could present people kind of in that way. And then it was sort of someone, and I had seen some of her work that she had done before, and then eventually somebody was like, well, what about Yvonne? And, like, then it clicked, like, yeah, of course, like, her stuff is perfect. Let me ask her. And, you know, because she, too, had a day job. It was one of those things where, like, you know, normally she didn't necessarily take on a lot of other projects that weren't her own as an illustrator. And she's got, I think, some of her own books out now, too. You know, but she's like, this is really important. I'd like to be a part of it. So that was kind of when we connected. And then in order, because the first one especially, too, like, I self-published them both. So the biggest expense for me was going to be paying her, because I believe in paying your artists professionally. They're professionals. That's what they do. So I wanted to make sure she was getting what she needed for being a part of the project.
Oh,
and
wow.
So I decided to do a Kickstarter, which I had also never done before. But I was like, you know, I ask people professionally for money all the time with these grants, but pitching such a personal idea and for a product that also wasn't made yet was different. But that first Kickstarter that I put together and put a lot of time in promoting raised over $8,000 from over 200 people all over the world. I think it was something like 8 or 9 countries who contributed.
Oh, wow.
And I thought I used it too to sort of build the social media following around the books. So it was pretty neat because, yep, of course, some of it was like, you know, my mom and friends of friends and people who I worked with, but also, you know, people from all over the world were like seeing it on Twitter and here's $20 or whatever. And like that felt,
yep,
pretty validating too, that the project was an important project. You know, it's one thing for, you know, your mom and your family to validate what you're doing, which is great. And I appreciate all of that, but it's different to have a total stranger validate it too. So, so that's how I did that. And then the success of the first one,
I said too fast because I'm really interested in the story. All right, so how did you collate down the first number of people? What was your system? What were your thoughts? How did you get down so that you would say, okay, well, here's a good representation?
Right, and that was hard because, like, there are so many other people who could be included in the type book, right? So I think I had a couple thoughts. I wanted it to be a diverse representation of fields. So if I'm going to say it's about STEM, it needs to include science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. I feel like sometimes, especially the M, gets left out when you talk about STEM, so I wanted to make sure I had mathematicians.
When data science ends up in every phone and every place and everything that we do, thank you. I'm sorry. That's personal passion. Continue the story.
Yeah, so I agree. And then also just a diverse representation of individuals. So I wanted to, again, with the goal of having everyone who picked up my book be able to relate to something, I wanted to make sure it had a lot of different looking people. So I wanted to make sure to include scientists with disabilities. I wanted to include a Muslim scientist who wore hijab. I wanted to include Black scientists. I wanted to include Native American scientists. So, like, I wanted to be able to include that whole range. So,
yes.
So that included, part of my, okay, who do I include in the book? And then for me, then it just started, okay, like, the first one especially, I didn't necessarily want to include a lot of people who I actually knew in my real life. Because, mm-hmm, I don't know, the whole project in general felt super personal. So I didn't want to, like, have anybody feel like they got, I don't know, feel bad that they didn't get picked to be in it. So, like, I wanted
it
to be honest, right? So I did use my network of scientists that I had built professionally to do some of my initial research, where I'd be like, you know, I want to feature, you know, an environmental scientist who does work with the Native American population. Like, do you know anybody, you know? And so sometimes that led me down a rabbit hole to meeting a person,
sure,
to do that. You know, other times it was just based on, you know, internet searches or people who I personally have looked up to over the years, like Dr. Ashanti Johnson or Dr. Myrea Mayor, Dr. Sylvia Earles in the first book, which was like, you know, Myrea Mayor called me one time when I was on vacation to say yes, and I totally like fangirled and was so excited. So some of it was just these things, like, I can't believe she's calling me right now. So it was kind of a range. And I had this huge spreadsheet of different names, like, and everyone would have been great, but then also I had to reach out and say, hey, this is who I am. This is the project I'm trying to do. You know, would you like to be a part of it? Because, you know, I wanted it to be based on interviews and people had to agree and be on board. So, you know, sometimes you reach out to people and you never hear back. You know, emails, mm-hmm, can get lost or people are super busy. So, like, overwhelmingly the response was, yes, I'm interested in the project, but that wasn't the, you know, 100% the response. So that was part of it too. And then I think part of it was just, timing, right? Like, some folks were like, I'm interested, but I don't have time right now. So,
yep.
And it was funny because going through for the first one, my initial like spreadsheet list, I was like, oh, this is great. But then I'd look and like half of them would be marine biologists, which is, you know, because that's my background. I think that's what I'm drawn immediately to. But then I'm like, wait, this isn't a book for me. This isn't a marine biologist volume. So let me back it up and like mix this up a little bit more. But yeah, I mean, so it was a very mixed bag of approaches to try to get that first group of 22 people. And I think part of it too was going back and forth with the illustrator just for design and printing purposes. Like you want a book to be the number of pages to be divisible by four with how it's printed. So, so part of it was just that like, okay. And then initially I think I had wanted 20 in the first book. And then it was one of those things where I was really trying to get a certain person and it was getting to the point where like I had to move to the next step and they hadn't said yes yet. And I was like, okay, I'm just going to move on. And I had already offered it to somebody else. And then they said yes at the last minute. I was like, okay, well, because I want to include you so much, I'm just going to up it 22. But I guess that's the thing about self-publishing too. Like you have a little bit more control over making some of those decisions. And it was the right decision for the book. So like, I'm glad I had the option to do that.
I like what you did that because self-publishing is merely a publishing company of one. You have all the same challenges that a publishing company has. You just have it down there. It's publishing.
Yeah, it was. And it was interesting, too, because then I had to do you're wearing all the hats. And I think from a lot of the work that I had done just in my professional life in higher ed, in, you know, grant work and grant programs and project management, like, you're wearing a lot of hats doing that kind of work too. So
absolutely.
I think it was one of those things where it was like, okay, let's just, but also again, with being trained in science, you know, let's break it down and figure it out. You don't know how to do it. Let's figure it out, you know, like, so it was definitely a learning as I went. And at the time of the first one, you know, I was doing this like in the evenings and the weekends on top of my director job.
Yeah.
So, it was definitely a learning curve, but I think that's part of why it was so fun because I got to connect to a lot of folks who I probably wouldn't have connected with otherwise in trying to figure out how to get some of this stuff completed.
Did you have during the process a process of ups and downs, times when you just shook your head and gone, what the hell have I gotten myself into? And then other times when you're high, this is the best thing that you ever had.
Of course I did. Yeah. I mean, there were moments where I'm like, I'm not a publisher. I'm not an author. Like, what am I doing? Am I qualified to do this? Like, I'm not really a practicing scientist, right? So, but I was more trying to be the outlet to let their stories shine through, right? Like, so I think, but a lot of the energy that I got from the project was really from the people, right? So from every time I would have an interview with one of the people in the book, I would just be so jazzed about like moving on to the next thing. Like, okay, great. This is important. This is doing what I want it to do. This is great. I'm going to keep going. And then, I think once it kind of came out and with going through the stages of the Kickstarter and stuff, when I started to get photos of kids and adults, but the kids ones were my favorite, no offense to any adult who sent me a picture, but, where they would color the pages and send them back to me. Right.
Yeah.
So, and not just because like, of course that's adorable, but because I saw in some of those things that the book was doing what I intended it to, or what I was hoping that it would do, where like, you know, I was getting pictures of little boys who would send in their coloring pages where it's, you know, yes, it's a book about women in science, but it's just as important for young men to understand that STEM fields are appropriate for women as it is for young women to see themselves in these fields. So, or I would get pictures from, you know, my friends who have like little black girls were submitting coloring pages and just coloring them to look like themselves, regardless of what the scientists look like in real life. Right. So, and I think that was one of the great things about it being a coloring book, because with black and white, like line drawings for the illustration pages, you don't, I mean, yes, there are nuances in the illustrations themselves where you could maybe like guess what the person looked like in real life, but like
sure.
The kids just colored it to look like them, which was the whole point, right? Like, oh. Because you're not sort of giving them any indication necessarily. It's not like a photo was posted next to this, like, oh, this is what this person looks like. Like, they just colored it to look like them. And I was like, this is exactly what I wanted it to do. And I would do some events and stuff around the book too. And I remember I was at the Science Center in Connecticut, up in Hartford, and I'd done a coloring event where, you know, we had some of the books for sale, but also we had pages printed out where the kids could come color with us and stuff. And these two little girls, maybe 8 and 10, ran over to the table and were so excited and, like, pointed to this one scientist she's biotechnology. But it was Miriam, and she's the scientist who happens to be Muslim, happens to wear hijab. And the girls were so excited about it. And then you hear them go, Mom, Mom, right? Like, calling their mom over. And then you see that Mom wears hijab, too. So, like, it was one of those things where, like, you could tell that they weren't necessarily used to seeing someone that looked like their mom in this type of stuff. So, like, that was powerful, too. It would be like, you know, this is why I made some of those decisions and why that, you know, representation matters. It is important.
It is. It is, and it is, men. We're here in Austin. I'm involved in an initiative called In Search of the New Compassionate Male. So how can we as men grow? How can we grow and have head and heart and to be able to grow so that we can come expand to the level where women are, so that we can, instead of having to keep the stereotype of what we grew up as, this weird thing about what men are and what men should be, and instead come to a new realization. And that's what I love about what you're doing, is that there is such a deep value of inclusiveness.
Thank you. I think that, you know, as also for me, like, I'm also a queer woman. So, like, I think, you know, sometimes you come across folks who may really seem against a certain group of people. And I think a lot of times that just comes from being unaware. I don't want to say uneducated. That's not the right word. But, you know, but a lack of understanding. And I think when people don't understand something, sometimes that's scary. And people react to being scared by being, you know, angry, or they put it off, or they're aggressive or whatever. And I think that in some ways that's just a, like, protective response, but it doesn't mean it's right. But so I think one of the biggest things we can do is sort of find those connection points. Like, I really truly believe we're more alike than we are different.
Thank you.
But unless you have a personal relationship with people who are different from you, like, you may not connect to some of these issues in the same way. And then it's also recognizing that, you know, yes, there are certain individuals that can be against a certain group, and that's totally wrong. Mm-hmm. But there are also systems that have been in place over the years, like, you know, higher education, a lot of stuff with STEM. Like, I mean, this is decades and decades and decades of the way systems work and have been put in place because they weren't originally set up for women or people of color, like, so, or people with disabilities. You know, it does, and it doesn't mean there aren't individuals trying to make that better, but it takes time for cultural change and for systemic change. But that's all the more reason for us to keep pushing to make those changes.
When I was a kid, the Crayola crayons, I remember this so clearly because it didn't make a dent on me at the time, but it remembers it. I remember it so clearly now. And so this was in the 50s, and then you get that big box of like 48 Crayola crayons, you know, that had all of the, and you pull out, there was one called Flesh.
Right.
And it was beige.
Right.
Stunned me now thinking of that. But that was the cultural, that was what was deeply put into, that's the kind of unconscious and conscious biases that we have all over the place, but there it was.
Mm-hmm.
I just was, and so that's what I'm so glad about, knowing that we can see this kind of diversity. So when you, of course, having a book, being an author in 2020 and beyond also means that you must be a promoter. You must be the
right
one who gets out in front of and go out. What was that process of beginning to go on shows, beginning to have interviews, having people like Renee Jaworski reach out to you and go, Sarah, we really want you on the show, please, please. And Dennis saying, please, please get her. And so what's that process like?
So, just like figuring out who to include in the book, it was a very multifaceted process for a couple of reasons. Like, I was doing it by myself. I didn't have a budget for marketing or events, and I was still working full time. Right. So a lot of events that I maybe would have really enjoyed to speak at, like if I didn't have the time off from work to take off and then the money to fly to wherever to do the speech,
Yeah,
that wasn't always just conducive for, then also the practicalities of my real life. So it was a mix of different things. But I think as far as finding the opportunities, I leveraged the social media that I built around. And then the people who were in the book also often sort of knew of different groups or opportunities. And then it also kind of built once I started doing some more public facing stuff like podcast interviews like this one or events at local bookstores or things like that,
sure,
more people would find out about it. There was more of a web presence. There was people, tweeting about it or whatever. So there was kind of a ripple effect from there. And I think that was definitely true with the first book, because at that point in my life, I had the time to really put in a lot more effort into that marketing when I had spare time. That hasn't always been true since the publication of the first book. So I kind of have to, pick and choose when I focus on the marketing for the books. Like, I wish I could do it full time,
mm-hmm,
but that's just not realistic. But it's been, even with just sort of doing that on like a bare bones kind of budget and time thing, like the amount of coverage I've been able to get from the book. And again, it comes down to people, right? Like, the people who are touched by the project and feel a connection to the project or the books, like they're the ones who reach out or tell their friend who does this thing. And a lot of times it starts local too. So like the first book event I ever did, when this was important to me, was in the school district that I grew up in. So they now, at the time they had a STEM program. They didn't have that when I was a kid, but it was an after school program with, I think, all four elementary schools in the district. So, I reached out to the person who ran that program. I was like, I want to bring this book home first. How can we do that? So we did that, and we ended up being able to get every kid in the program a copy of the book, and I was able to schedule a presentation when I was also home for a visit to see my family at the same time. So I was able to go in and do a presentation. They had all four school groups come together after school one day, and I was able to talk to all these kids in the town that I grew up in about this stuff, and then, answer their questions and hear how excited they were about what they wanted to do. So that was pretty powerful to be able to bring it home first. So I think, you start with where you are, right? That's how you do anything. You start with where you are and who you know and what you have. And then it kind of, hopefully it grows from there.
You continue, and it is also.
So it's also one of those things where sometimes you just have to be okay with the chance of being turned down, right? And I think sort of going through the process of having to cold call or cold email and reach out to these amazing people to be in the books in the first place helped me practice that a little bit, where it's like, I listened to this podcast or this program and I really like it, I'm going to write to them and tell them about this. And if they like it, they'll say, yes, we're interested. And if they don't, I'll move on to the next one. Right. So part of it was also just like a numbers game. Like, I'm going to do research on this many programs and see if they want to either have me speak or if they want to do a bulk order or whatever. It was just sort of a numbers game of how many programs and how many people can I ask, and let's see how many say yes. But in order to do that, like, you have to be okay with being told no. which I know it's not always an easy thing. Like, it's something I'm not super comfortable with, but like sometimes that's just how it goes. And you have to deal with so many no's before you get a yes.
How human, right? I talk with women who are in politics or wanting to go into politics, or, and one of the hardest things that they will say, and it's not just women, it's men also, is how do you ask for money? And how do you ask and to be able to do that? Because it's a whole different perspective. And so what's now? What's now for Sarah McSorley? What's cooking on the back burners that you are willing or can share about, and what does it look like?
Well, that's a great question. So, like, the past couple years of my life, especially since the publication of the second volume of Super Cool Scientist, have had a lot of different transitions professionally and personally. So I think this is the point where that's finally starting to settle out a little bit for me. So I will be able to really focus on what comes next. You know, I've always wanted to sort of take Super Cool Scientist to the next level, whether that's a different version of the coloring book or, you know, a version of it that's not a coloring book at all, but sort of still something in the book arena. So I'm still trying to figure out exactly what that looks like, but it's, you know, I'm hoping that I'm approaching a time where I'll actually be able to put a lot more time and energy into figuring out how to do that and how to grow it into something different than it is now.
What is your creative process? Do you go for walks? Do you have your ideas in different ways, in different places? Do you journal? Do you meditate? What is Sarah McSorley's creative process in general? I know you can't boil it down to one thing, but give me a picture.
Yeah, I wish I could boil it down to one thing. That would be productive. But I think
make it simple.
It depends. Like, it's one of those things where, you know, sometimes I'm in a mood to create, like, creatively write something, and other times I'm not. Like, so, and it's hard to sit down and force it for me when it's creative writing. So I kind of have to be able to take advantage of those moments where I really want to write stuff down. And then if I need to just sort of be in the grind mode, like, I need to be able to sit down and do some other type of work related to the project, whether that's, you know, go through and do some social media work, whether that's go through and, you know, do some other, whether it's outlining or finding more resources to include in the books or on the website, or, you know, sort of something else that's not the actual writing itself. And then sometimes that spurs that desire, and I think, you know, doing it so kind of part-time and when I had time, like, there were moments where I definitely had to just, like, sit down and get something done in order to sort of meet my deadlines, but it's a process for me where, you know, if I force it, I feel like it's not as good, so, like, I have to be able to sort of really grab onto those moments where the creativity hits me and I'm like, oh, this is how I want to frame this interview or this article or whatever. Like, let me go take care of that right now. I don't know that I have more of a set, like, process and how that happens, other than just trying to take advantage of it when that comes up for me.
Well, you know, it's interesting that in the new economy, where we're going on from now on, we're much more in a gig worker economy where people need people just in time, bring them together, do the project, then they disperse. So the model of what you and I are working, the way we are working, is going to be much more like the future than the past, where you just went to one organization and worked with them your entire career during your time. So it feels like more of what we're on the leading edge of what's coming. Does that give you a sense too? Do you have that sense too?
I'm not sure, because I think, like, I've done this in sort of a mix of different ways, right? So, like, when I started, I was a full-time director at a university. As the first book had come out, and I was sort of coming through the ideas for the second one, they ended up closing my department. So I was approaching a year of shutting down what I was hired to build up. And then unemployment, right? So, because I had consciously made the decision I wanted to stay to help it to help close it down and help transition the programs and make sure my team was okay instead of just jumping ship as soon as we found out. So, you know, that was something that I chose to do. And then the timing actually worked out well in a way because my niece was being born, my mom was getting me married. So I made the decision, okay, when this is the closing happens, I'm going to go live in my hometown for a few months while all these things are going on, help out, and then figure out what I'm doing next. And had the ability to do that. Like, and I felt lucky to sort of have that option to be able to kind of take a break and reflect a little bit, like, am I really where I want to be in my career? So during that time, like, I was able to focus on getting the second book finished and pushed out. But even doing that, like, I've learned that I'm not my best boss. So, like, I do better with the structure of working for someone else. And that's just something I know from that I've learned about myself. So that's definitely a thing for some people. And then I, you know, was at a point where I needed to start working again. So, like, I had found a part-time remote position for a while doing some recruiting. And then I ended up moving states again and landed in the position I'm in now, which is this writer for the marketing department of an online education company. But that started as a contractor, which was like, you know, no benefits. And if you take time, you don't get paid for your time, which is the reality for so many people in the world. But it was different than the type of jobs that I had done. So sort of dealing with that new reality and what that meant for my budgets and how I had to look at my expenses and stuff. And only recently that transferred to being a full-time, you know, permanent position. So it's definitely been a learning process over the last couple of years. It hasn't just been like, oh, I'm just going to focus on this gig stuff. Because honestly, very little of what I've done with the book has actually paid me, right? So I've done a lot of it volunteer. I've gotten a lot of great promotion for it, but that doesn't always transfer to sales. And sometimes that's because the audience is like school districts who struggle with budgets for things like materials and the places that really need it.
Yep.
So, and even if I'm doing it at cost to get it to the folks who really need it, some places can't even afford that, and I can't necessarily... I can do so many donations per year and I can do it at cost. So at least I'm not losing money on it, but it's like, you have to weigh all those decisions for things that come up.
Totally. Totally. All right. I want to end. What I want to end on is I don't know of any writer that is not a reader. So I'd like two things to hear from you. Three things, actually. One is, what have we not talked about that's on your mind or your heart right now? Let's do that one first, so we make sure I don't forget that and we run out of time. What should we talk about?
Ooh, that's a broad one. I think we covered a lot of important stuff. I think, you know, one of the things right now, especially in like everything going on in the world, is just sort of a reminder that a lot of the folks who are out there trying to figure out how to deal with the virus and how it affects people.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of those folks are STEM people, like not just the healthcare, but the researchers who are trying to find different solutions, whether it's, you know, how to print more, like 3D print more face shields or, you know, and you're seeing folks who are in those professional fields. You're seeing folks who are kind of not in those areas professionally, but still finding ways to step up and do that. So I think it's just sort of, another opportunity to think about, you know, how can we as individuals help? Because I think at the end of the day, it's all about the people. Like, and that's been true with my work and the books and everything. So I think it's, even though we're being told to stay away from other people, it's a time to really not forget about other people.
Exactly. And find different ways to make that connection, even if it is a virtual one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Okay. Second thing that I want to ask. Who were your early influences in reading? The people that you read, the books that you read that perhaps are the authors that made you go, yeah, man, this is something great.
Well, I think I've always had, it hasn't necessarily been one specific author or one specific genre. It was more like trying to fill different areas, right? So like I've always been into books about science, books about scientists.
Mm-hmm.
I've always liked, you know, certain types of biographies, people writing about their lives, reading about people's stories, especially if it's coming directly from them. You know, I've always enjoyed reading those types of things. And then as I got older, like, I'm into, you know, crime solving, James Patterson kind of stuff just for fun. But, and
sure.
I think, you know, as I've gotten older and doing some more of the work that I've done through higher ed and through the books, like, you know, really trying to find books written by people who have a very different perspective than me, just to try to, you know, sort of glean some more information about, you know, again, sort of trying to understand people who may be different than me, to think through, you know, some of the own things that may be in my head based on my experience, just to kind of expand how I can think on some of those things that other people go through.
Just as a question, because I have not seen the book and I have not read the biographies on that great Dennis, sorry. Anyhow, where I am, were you able to include any gay or lesbian scientists? Or would that even be a criteria for the kids at that time that you would want to be able to include this?
Yes, I was able to include that. And I think it's always good for people to see, regardless of your age. I mean,
right.
The books themselves, the text is geared towards, like, upper elementary school, middle school.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, I've gotten feedback that kids much younger than that enjoy them. They're just having the stories read to them versus reading them themselves, you know, and adults and college kids enjoy them too. But yeah, I think, you know, anytime you can, I hate some of these words, right? So, like, normalize it, like, it's very normal for a lot of people, but again, just making it more like, it shouldn't be a surprise. Like, it shouldn't be like, you know, they're just people, they go to work, they have their families, like, you know, it's just, everybody's just a little bit different, and that's okay.
Exactly. And that's what I love about the spectrum. And one Thomas Friedman, the economist, he wrote a book called The World is Flat, and he talked about one of the most important jobs of the 21st century will be the great explainers. And you making these, you taking these scientific principles and this and getting them to where we can really understand them and understand how valuable they are and how it might relate to us, puts you right into that category. That's such a such a delight to know that you're there, that you're doing your work. And I'm looking forward to seeing just exactly what Sarah McSorley is going to be producing in the future. And I want you to know that you have certainly inspired me with what I'm doing with my work. At my age, I'm going through much of the same things that you are, is taking my work out there. And I get a chance to do these wonderful conversations like I have with you. And I so appreciate your time today. And I look forward to getting a chance to seeing what you're going to be doing in the future.
Thank you, Dennis. I really appreciate you having me on. I think it's been a good talk.
All right. Good enough. We'll talk with you again. All right. Thank you, everybody. This has been Dennis Tardon and Sarah McSorley, and we'll see you next time.